It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying, there is no running, there is no hiding, there's only fighting or dying. It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying, there is no running, there is no hiding, there's only fighting or dying.
It's Going Down is a digital community center from anarchist, anti-fascist, autonomous, anti-capitalist, and anti-colonial movements. Our mission is to provide an autonomous and resilient platform to publicize and promote revolutionary theory and action.
Go to itsgoingdown.org for daily updates. Check out our online store for ways to donate and rate and follow us on iTunes if you like this podcast.
Hi, my name's Kim Kelly. I live in New York. I'm from the Pine Barrens in South Jersey, if you've ever seen the Sopranos episode. Our only pop culture point, that and the Jersey Devil. It's great. I'm a writer and an editor and an organizer and a pain in the ass for people who think fascism is cool. And I'm really happy to be talking to you.
Awesome. Thanks. Well, I guess the first question is, how did you get interested in anarchism and autonomous politics? And that did that come before you became a journalist and a writer, or was it at the same time?
Well, I've always been a writer. I've been doing, I suppose, journalism in some way, shape, or form since I was 15. That's when I first started doing, writing and getting published. So I guess the writing came first. And then as I grew up and, you know, read more and saw more of the world and, you know, became more politically aware, my current political beliefs came into play. Like, I started out as just a general, like, baby liberal. I protested, and my first protest was when I was 16, when Dick Cheney came to speak at a neighboring high school. So I made a whole, like, anti-war shirt and went out there and, like, yelled at him. It's great. And I was very into Michael Moore back then. Yeah, right. Went from that into like a little bit more socialistic, a little bit more like, oh, what is this feminism thing? And then I started reading Marx, as one does, and was just sort of like a very lazy Marxist for years, because I spent most of my time also just being a metalhead, and politics didn't really take, like politics were important because I always wrote about, you know, sexism and racism and the problems in the metal community. But as I got older, especially in college and then after college, I got just started reading more and trying to figure out what I actually believed, what I wanted the world to look like, how I wanted to be involved. And after being a lazy communist for years and still having that niggling thing in the back of my head, like, this is like mostly cool, but there are some big problems that I'm just really, the whole gulag thing seems maybe not great. I have some questions, but I didn't really know. I know I'm the worst. I'm sorry. I have so many commie friends. I'm sorry. But I didn't really know any people that were involved in radical politics or really that political at all up until way after college, because I was just in music world. But I always read a lot, and I found this book. I think it was like 2014, 2015. I just happened upon it in an anarchist bookstore in Montreal when I was up speaking at this metal conference. It was called Sasha and Emma, and came out in 2012, I believe. It's just this really beautifully written, sort of twin biography of, you know, Alexander Berkman and Emma Goldman, their relationship and their history and everything that happened around them. And I just remember reading that and reading, you know, their thoughts and what they were fighting for and their reasonings. I was just like, oh, so this is the thing I was looking for. Everything makes sense now. And then, you know, from there you start reading their work, and then you find Lucy Parsons, and you find Voltairine de Cleyre, you find all of these dope thinkers who are saying exactly what you've always kind of felt but didn't have the words or the knowledge or education to really articulate. And after that, there's really no going back once you find anarchism, because there's nothing better.
Yeah, and we're going to talk about the metal stuff later. So, wait, so you went to there's a conference on metal?
Oh, there's a whole...
is there like one person that just growls and there's one person that screams and then that's the...
Wow, okay. So, all right. I can tell you're a metalhead. I just happen to be on this thing. I was actually, ironically speaking, on a panel about sexism in metal. I've always been political because my existence is political, you know. I'm a woman who is in, I've always been in the metal scene, which is a very, very heavily white, heavily cis, heavily straight,
right,
dude heavy scene, and always sticking out in that scene and seeing how my other friends who were from other marginalized backgrounds felt and were treated in that scene, like, you have to push back against that no matter how you can, especially if you have, like, white lady privilege, which I have. So that's always been a part of my work anyway, and it just sort of, you know, once I figured out, like, where I really stood politically, it all just made sense to tie it all together.
Yeah, and we're really going to dive into the metal stuff at the end of the interview, and I'm excited to talk about that. But just going forward, I think a lot of people, especially those that are listening that, you know, are writing or... I mean, like, it's going down. We interact with a lot of people that are journalists. But I'm just curious, how did you end up going from starting to write when you're 15 and then all of a sudden you're writing for Vice and Teen Vogue and some of these bigger publications? I think a lot of people that are interested in journalism or want to get their stuff out there, it might be hard to think about, okay, how do I actually get onto some of these bigger platforms?
Right. So I guess, I mean, first of all, I'm 30 now, so it hasn't been super sudden. I spent the past 15 years writing and being published and trying to hone my craft and making connections. Like any sort of people-heavy industry, connections are everything. So to back up, started writing about... Well, it's funny that I'm talking about my work in this context because it's only been the past few years where I've really concentrated heavily on cultural and political work. Up until, you know, a few years ago, I was known as a heavy metal writer. Like, that's been most of my career. So, which is why I keep bringing up metal and totally screwing up the flow of your interview question.
It's great.
But like, that's where I'm from, right? So, like, I started writing for, like, little baby zines and blogs and things when I was 15, writing for, like, my county paper through a little, like, mentorship program. Very cute. And then just sort of I was one of the only young, like, girls who were writing about this particularly black metal, death metal, like, really heavier stuff. So I stood out a little bit. So there's a little bit of tokenization. And also, I'm a pretty good writer. I have a very, you know, well-developed work ethic. I'm good at what I do. I've always been pretty good at doing this specific, extremely weird thing. And that's helped me out over the years. But I started out really young, and then I made connections by going to shows. I made connections by, I spent years touring. I was a merch person for a bunch of different bands for like 4 years straight after college. So I got to meet tons of people in the business that way. I ran a PR company for about 8 years. So I met a ton of other writers and editors through doing that. I just sort of built my own network that way. But I went from writing specifically about like heavy metal for little blogs to building up my clips, building up like an actual body of work, meeting more people, and kind of weaseling my way into, I guess, bigger things like Metal Maniacs and Terrorizer and Decibel, like metal-specific publications.
Right.
And through that, built up my portfolio, made more connections, ended up writing for things like Pitchfork and Spin and Stereogum. And once you have those kind of names on your resume, once you have a couple good bylines, you can kind of parlay that into writing for more generally mainstream things. Like, I've written about metal for The Guardian and for NPR and the Chicago Reader. Like, if you get to that point where you know your shit, you can sell a story, you can back up what you're selling. Honestly, there are so many, I mean, there's just flaky editors and flaky people at every step of the process, but it's hard to be a writer and kind of, you just have to be good and dedicated and on top of your shit, because there are so many other people that want to do what you're doing. If you sell a story to a really cool publication, and for every 3 people that congratulate you, like 10 others are trying to figure out, okay, how can I do that?
Right.
Like, it's sort of calculating business, which is kind of brutal. But I guess stone cold bitch, I guess.
Yeah, it's a vicious business.
I know, it's really dark. And it's just, you know, a lot of it is access. A lot of it is meeting people. Like, I've been heavily involved in my specific scene for my entire life, so I've had that leg up. Really, yeah, I've always... I suppose the biggest thing that sort of jump-started a lot of my being able to write for bigger things was I've been working for Vice since 2014. I was freelancing there purely through, like, the classic media Vice thing network. Like, I had a friend who was an editor there who needed somebody to write about metal, So I started writing about metal, and I just kept doing it. And they eventually were like, well, I guess we'll give you a job. So I've been there since for a while. And like once you end up in that sort of ecosystem, you have a lot more access to other people, like who have other connections. Like you have that byline, so you have a little bit of heft and like weight behind your name.
Uh-huh.
So it's easier to be like, hey, this is Kim from Vice. I would like to pitch you this thing, instead of just like, hey, I'm Kim from broke ass middle of nowhere. I have a really cool idea. You're not going to listen, are you? Like,
right.
It takes a lot of upward motion, a lot of like grit, and a lot of like hustling to get to a point where you can make people listen to you. But even things like, I've totally cold pitched lots of places. I cold pitched Teen Vogue, just being like, I think the first thing I wrote for them, it was about the Bronx Freedom Fund, how they're trying to raise money to get kids off of Rikers in time for the first day of school. And they liked that story, so I got to do that, and we formed this working relationship. But it's a lot of the time it's a shot in the dark. Being a freelance writer is really tough.
Mm-hmm. And
the fact that I've been able to trick enough people into letting me do cool things for them is just, it boggles my mind still. I'm still like, do you really me? I'm like this redneck heavy metal anarchist kid. You want to give me space in your publishing? Mm-hmm. All right.
I'm just curious. I mean, there's so much talk these days about the mainstream media. I mean, like, you know, the president calls it the enemy of the people. You know, obviously for anarchists, we've grown up with people like Noam Chomsky that have talked about manufacturing consent and the role of the mainstream media in capitalist democracies. But I'm curious, like, since you've been in the media yourself and you see how it works, what do you think everyday people kind of need to know about, you know, how the sausage is made?
It is a dirty business, I'll tell you that. It is, the ingredients are all fucked up. More seriously, it's, you know, it's not as bad and also not as good as people outside of this ridiculous bubble would expect.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the most glaring issues with the mainstream media, quote unquote, or the media in general, is the fact that there are so many barriers to entry for people who are not just like nice white kids from the suburbs who went to NYU to be able to sort of funnel straight into nice media jobs and tell nice media stories and just not really ever venture outside of the bubbles or their comfort zones because they don't have that educational experience. Like there's so many barriers to entry in terms of class and economics and race and gender and immigration status, all of the things that keep people marginalized and keep marginalized voices quieted and muffled. Like those are the voices that are the most important to get out there, and they're the ones who have the least access to these spaces because there's just so many structural issues working against them.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So yeah, so there's no way to claim that the current state of media is fair or representative of the actuality of people's lives because there just aren't enough places at the table and enough microphones to go around because too many nice white kids from Connecticut who went to NYU who are probably very nice humans had it a lot easier than a kid from Brownsville or a kid from where I'm from. And it's very frustrating, honestly, to be in this realm as I almost feel like an infiltrator because I am not I'm not the kind of person who should be here. I'm like from middle of nowhere, redneck, working class, Trump's America, nowhere. And somehow I ended up here. And just seeing seeing the way that you know, that wave of, I think it was 2016, all of those pieces about the white working class ruined everything, and all of these sympathetic or sort of almost predatory pieces that came out about Trump voters and Trump supporters where they would show like some toothless guy or like some woman who was struggling to breathe, all these things. Like they would show people that look like my family, and I would be in there in these newsrooms with people talking about like these dumb rednecks screwing up for everybody, and I'd be like, okay, well, I guess I'll go fuck myself because that's where I'm from and people don't.
Where were they, you know, a year ago talking about how neoliberalism is creating the conditions for people to be like, yeah, Trump may be the only solution. You know, right. Where were they then?
This parachute journalism thing that became such a trend is just so disheartening too. But I think there are so many really good people in this ecosystem too. Like I want to stress that as well, especially I've learned that to skip back and also forward. One of your questions is about the wave of unionization that happened. I've been deeply involved in that. One of the main organizers of the Vice Union, I'm on the council for the Writers Guild of America East, who are behind a ton of this organizing. And through that work, I've met so many great hardworking, smart, like savvy people who actually care, who are in this business and they want to tell these stories. And they're not all just the nice white kids from Connecticut. Like they're out here doing the work and they're trying so hard. And we're just all kept under the thumbs of these craven billionaire capitalist douchebags who happen to own our means of production. And there's not that much you can do about that besides completely disengaging and doing something like what you do or what I want to see people do. And I'm trying to sort of plant the seeds, because I don't think I'm smart enough to do it myself, but I know people are, is to sort of get people to actually commit to forming these sort of worker-owned, autonomous, community-supported media outlets where we're actually telling these stories that need to be out there, where we're getting support from communities, and where we're not being beholden to people who don't care whether we live or die as long as we hit our traffic goals.
Right. I mean, that's where we need to go. I mean, we need to start. I mean, in our view, and we've had conversations with other like-minded media projects, but because there are a lot of, you know, there's a lot of cool media going on, whether it's like anarchist stuff, like Unicorn Ride, IGD, Submedia, to, you know, just a lot of independent stuff. But I mean, I think a lot of these things we need to start thinking about consolidating and like making videos and doing daily shows and all that stuff. I mean, competing with not only what the right's putting out, but also the mainstream. But yeah, thank you for sharing your thoughts. I'm curious, you know, I think one of the ways this kind of these tensions that you're talking about played out the most was recently with, you know, the whole hype around anti-fascism and Antifa. And you recently wrote a piece on Medium, which kind of went after the media for everything that it got wrong about anti-fascism. I'm curious if you can talk about that and kind of how that relates to some of these things that we've been talking about already.
Sure. So that was, as initially, believe it or not, that was going to be on Teen Vogue. But it happened. It just got killed because of timing. My editor was out of town. Whatever, it's fine. But so I just put it up on Medium, and because I wanted to get it out there, because after I got home from being down in D.C. and seeing everything that went down, you always check, like, okay, what is the media narrative this time? What did we do this time? And the narrative that I kept seeing was that, oh, well, Antifa was super violent, and they, like, attacked journalists, and they did this, that, and the other. And I was like, well, I was literally right there, and that is a gross, just a sort of gross mischaracterization of events. And also, why doesn't anybody seem to care that there were literal dozens of people with cameras and filming equipment standing in front of a black block full of people that were not nice white kids from Connecticut who were trying to accomplish a certain goal? They would stop us every few blocks, if that. We would just stop and be sitting ducks surrounded by the cops in the middle of D.C. so people could get their fucking shots off and sell it to Reuters or sell it to AP. And it's just, there's this thing that I've noticed from being involved in various things, being in a lot of these situations and having sort of the media perspective as well as my actual, you know, politics and what I'm actually up to, just seeing the way that so many media folks just don't see anti-fascists as people. Like, we're sort of reduced to a shot or to a quote or to just this sort of almost anonymous boogeyman that you can use as a cool lead for your article. I remember at one point I was like hugging my boyfriend, and I saw some person with a camera just like taking a shot of us, like taking a bunch of pictures of us. And we weren't recognizable at the time. So I was like, okay, that's fine, I guess. Rude, but okay. But I went up to him. I was like, hey, so who are you shooting for? And he told me the outlet he was shooting for. And I was like, oh, I write for them too. And the look on his face was just like I told him I was the Queen of England. He just couldn't put the two together. Like, oh, this person whose face I'm not recognizing also does this job that I do? Like, does that mean that they're a normal person? That doesn't compute to me. I think there's been such a sort of impulse to characterize anti-fascism, anti-fascist work as this sort of this alien, bizarre, hyper-violent, almost tapestry of chaos. And the thought that the people who are actually involved in doing this work are anything besides like absolute maniacs just seems to completely fall off the radar. Like, it's just very frustrating, especially when you're in that specific situation and you come home and you're like, cool, the good guys won, and your whole timeline is just like, look at these crazy, horrible kids breaking these nice people's expensive cameras. Like, well, maybe if you hadn't shoved it in somebody's face while they're trying to walk away from the cops, something wouldn't have happened to your precious camera. Like, does a person's life or freedom matter more than equipment? That was probably expensive, but it's just, it's very strange to be sort of in this middle limbo where I am, where I understand the media perspective, but I also am coming from the anti-fascist anarchist perspective, and I just have all of these thoughts and all these emotions about everything, which is why I write about them all the time.
Well, I think the anti-fascism thing is really interesting because, I mean, in the lead up to the, you know, Trump's inauguration, they just rolled out the red carpet so hard for the alt-right. I mean, there were just so many explainer pieces, and we're going to actually talk about your piece in Teen Vogue about anarchism in a minute, but I mean, there were so many explainer pieces about the alt-right. I mean,
they're so dapper.
Yeah, they're so dapper, picking apart every little part of it, like explaining, like basically giving anybody any sort of, like, you know, roadmap into this movement if they wanted to. And I mean, like, you know, on the other side, like, you know, I haven't seen that hardly at all. I've seen the Teen Vogue piece. There was also something in something called Mel Magazine, which I don't think many people have heard of, that was about the contemporary anarchist movement. But, I mean,
it's so weird, right? Because, like,
nobody wanted to do that with anarchists or with anti-fascists, really. They just wanted this kind of, you know, living trope of, you know, kids in black masks.
Because it threatens the status quo. Like, if anybody... Right. is actually given a platform allowed to say, okay, so it's not, there's something out there besides Democrat or Republican. That kind of, the whole little house of cards of, like, neoliberal bullshit just falls apart when you're just like, well, there is something better, and people are actually putting their bodies on the line to try and achieve that totally just takes apart, like, their entire worldview. And it's just like, well, why are you satisfied with not even mediocrity, with just this, the banality of evil? Like, why are you so afraid to even platform for a minute someone who's like, you know, it doesn't have to be like this.
Right. The thing that I heard from a lot of journalists over the years is just that, like, well, we can put, like, a Matthew Heimbach on TV and he's going to say some shit, you know, and, like, freak people out or, you know, make them mad, and, like, people will watch it, you know, whereas opposed to the other feeling I've got is that, you know, if we give somebody like you a platform, then our boss is going to get mad at us because we're like, we've actually interacted with journalists that have gotten pushback for, you know, quoting us or you know, writing about, you know, anarchists or anti-fascists in a neutral light. So, I mean, that's very real. And I think that's a very interesting dichotomy that, you know, the alt-right sells because it's, you know, like, Nazis, ooh, you know, evil or, you know, weird or strange, and then, but, you know, we can't really talk about, you know, a movement of working class people fighting capitalism.
Right, so it doesn't, you know, Nazis don't threaten the boss's bottom line. They're workers regaining some actual class consciousness and realizing that capitalism and the people benefiting from capitalism are the actual problem. Now that scares the bosses, and the bosses are what control the media, which is why we gotta fix this shit. We'll be right back.
Well, all that aside, recently there's, you know, you had a great piece published in Teen Vogue that was an introduction to anarchism. You know, fantastic. I think a lot of people were really happy with it. And just the idea of, you know, I mean, people have made so many jokes recently about Teen Vogue because they have had a lot of really great articles just about, I mean, they seem to be one of the few publications that actually will cover, like, social movements. They had an interview with Mark Bray. I mean, they've had a lot of great stuff. But I'm just curious, one, just kind of like how the piece came about, and two, what kind of feedback you've heard from it.
So how it came about, I have such a cool editor there. Like, everybody I've worked with there, it's been a couple people now, have just been so down. Like, I think ever since, maybe a couple years ago, when Teen Vogue kind of made a hard pivot towards covering actual social justice and actual political movements, they've been really kind of open to throwing things at a wall and seeing what sticks. And apparently people are interested in reading about radical politics and radical perspectives. Like, I got to do this Anarchism Explained because I'd previously done a couple other reported pieces, and I did a labor unions explainer that went bizarrely viral. So they're like, okay, that's cool. And then I did one about capitalism that also people were also interested in that. And then I was like, okay, so when are you going to let me do one about anarchism? Almost as a joke. And they're like, oh, okay, that could be cool. So I was like, oh, okay. But, like, for real, though, like, let me do one about anarchism. And they're like, okay. It's really because I happen to have a really good relationship with my editor, and she gets where I'm coming from. She knows my whole deal, and she knows that people click these articles. Like, this article, thousands of people have read this. Like, right. I saw some of the numbers, and I was just like, okay, people are into this. And, I mean, that translates into a win for us because there is a piece about – like a simple piece about anarchism that was written by an anarchist that's now being read by tons of curious people. And it works out well for them because they're getting those clicks. It's a sort of symbiotic win right there.
Right.
But, I mean, the thing that it wasn't – so the thing about writing about radical politics and radical perspectives for big-ass mainstream media places is that you can't – it's not like writing for IDD. Like, if I wrote something for you, I would give it to you and you would put it on the internet and then it would be there. At a place like Teen Vogue, I wrote something and I sourced it and I sent it to my editor, and then she went through and she edited it. And anything that we disagreed on, we talked about. Like, she's great. We worked out. I pushed back on a few things. They wanted to take out the section that was what's the difference between anarchism and communism? Because she was like, well, this is a little granular for our readers. Like, because we have to keep in mind, like, this is Teen Vogue, like,
this is
some of the criticism I saw is like, okay, well, this doesn't get into the nitty-gritty of like mutualism, or like it doesn't touch on indigenous anarchism enough, or it doesn't touch on this or that. And like, yo, I hear you for real, and I wish I could have been even more in depth. And when I first turned it in, there was a lot more in there. but this thing, like, this is a magazine for teens who need an introductory perspective. Like, they need it to be on their level. And, like, yeah, teens are brilliant. But if I'm going to come straight out the gate with this super theory-heavy, super dense tract explaining everything about this beautiful philosophy of art, it's going to lose. You got to break it down.
Right.
So, yeah, turn it in. And then also, so the way Teen Vogue works is, like, I think something gets edited. We get it to a point where we're like, cool, this is good. We're both happy with this. And then there's a fact checker who goes through and checks every source and, like, questions every source. And for something like this, a lot of the most interesting and vibrant writing on anarchism is written by anarchists and hosted on anarchist media sites. So a fact checker at Condé Nast is going to be like, okay, that's cool, but can you find a more academic source? Like, right. Go to encyclopedia, go to this, go to that, because they don't want to be seen as partisan. Like, these things, before they get published, they have to be airtight, because especially something like this, the right wing is going to lose their shit about, so they can't leave any holes for them to really dig into.
There was an article in the Daily Caller, of course, about Teen Vogue, but I mean, was that like something that you all talked about? Like, you know, the Tucker Carlson's going to, you know, his ass is going to fall off as soon as this article comes out.
We kind of joke about it because, like, I mean, obviously, I'm not going to go on Tucker Carlson. Like, it's not going to be a thing. And I'm also used to people being mad at me online. Like, I've been a heavy metal journalist for 15 years. I'm really used to people being upset about what I do online. But writing about something like anarchism for a place like Teen Vogue, like, the topic and the platform are so, like, it's such a big thing that, yeah, a part of me was like, man, is this going to end up on Fox News? Like, is my grandma going to call me? Like, I'm glad she didn't. She's very old and very sweet, and her brain is full of Fox News. But
yeah.
God, like, and getting it out there. I mean, getting it out there felt really good. It took, God, I think I followed about a month ago. It took like a month or so to get it to a point where where we're good to publish. And that's also one of the reasons why Mark Bray is included, because there were a couple of sections where they're sort of more complex topics that I was trying to break down. And they're like, can we simplify this? And can you just call someone, like call like a primary source,
right,
and get about this? So it's easier to fact check and it's easier to sort of put down. So it's like, okay, I'll just call Mark because he's a friend and like, he's great. And that's why he ended up in the piece also, which is also like super fun that I'm just like, I've got Mark Bray and Teen Vogue again. So it was a really pleasant process. And then I'm glad, you know, it was a little defanged because it's give anarchist a pen and like, we're going to say some shit, but it's, I'm happy with them. Stoked that it came out, and the reaction's been so positive. I was really scared about this purely because this is something that I hold so close to my heart and like my entire being. And I was like, okay, if I publish this and everyone hates it, I'm gonna be so sad.
Right. No, I thought it was great. You know.
Thank you. I got almost entirely positive reactions. I saw some people. There are some critiques that were like, oh, why is this on a place like Teen Vogue, like this capitalist enterprise? I'm like, Yeah, I feel you, but I understand. But also, now a fuck ton of teenage girls are going to read about anarchism, and I feel like that is worth selling a tiny part of my soul, you know?
Right.
Like,
yeah.
And by the means sometimes. And I'm really happy that, like, 9,000 people or whatever read this clear-eyed, secretly very positive breakdown of anarchism. I mean, and it did well, and now I'm gonna get to do more radical shit. Like, the next thing I'm gonna do for them in this vein is a prison abolition explainer.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. And that helps everybody too, because that punches through that wall, and it's like, you know, we're in Teen Vogue. What are you talking about? You know, like,
this is the thing, right? I feel like I'm almost like an anarchist plant in media, because I right? Then like out here just like spreading propaganda in these really unexpected places, because I do have this access that I've ended up with through like privilege and hard work. And it's like, okay, I'm here. I like snuck in. Now what can I do to break down more walls and bring in all my friends?
Mm-hmm.
Like, what can I do to get these ideas and these perspectives out there before people notice what I'm getting away with?
Right. Well, I just wanted to ask you some other questions about media stuff. You know, if and when Trump leaves office, you know, under whatever circumstances, what do you think that's going to mean for the media? And especially, what do you think it'll mean for more mainstream sources covering social struggles? Like, you know, if the Democrats, you know, take over the House, take over the presidency, are they going to be like, you know, enough of that protesty shit, you know? Because some people would argue, like, the reason that we're been given a little tiny bit of the limelight is just because so many people hate Trump, and just, you know, it's allowed a little more for a little more radical voices to kind of come out. But I'm curious your thoughts.
You know, it's an interesting question. I do wonder about that. I do think the general tenor and frantic pace of the news isn't going to let up, even if Elizabeth Warren or Bernie or whatever do win. Like, I don't think there's any going back to media pre-Trump, you know, like, it's broken now. Like, there's no going back to whatever we perceived as normal media. And in terms of the way they cover, like, our movement and other social movements, I really don't know. So, I mean, we've all seen that iconic sign, like, if Hillary was president, I'd be at brunch right now. Oh, I think a lot of people are going to go back to brunch, and a lot of people who realize that there are still these glaring, violent, horrible structural inequalities in our system are going to be like, yo, like, we're not done, though. Like, Becky, come back.
Yeah.
Like, we're not done, nearly. No, nowhere near being done. But in terms of the way that people, like, media is going to cover whatever happens post-Trump, I'm as curious as you are. Like, I think I think enough people in media world have not been radicalized, but I think their eyes have been opened to so many of the horrible things that are happening in this world via Trump. Like, I mean, I don't think that reporting on the border is going to go back. I don't think that reporting on, you know, women's and non-binary people's bodily autonomy is going to go back. Because once you let those out, like once those stories are out there, you can't stuff them back into that Pandora's box. You can't just pretend in 4 years, okay, well, like the border is still this fucked up imperialist genocidal thing that's destroying people's lives, but it's cool now. We have a Democrat. Like, I think the fact that all of this has come to light, like all of this toxic sludge that's been pooling has just flooded the media landscape. I don't think that journalists and media outlets, any with any shred of integrity at least, will be able to turn a blind eye. And I think that we're going to keep seeing more stories about what's happening. And I think more people in media are going to care about what's happening. And in terms of like the anti-fascist menace, like, I guess it also depends on what we're going to have to fight against in 3 years or 4 years, you know? Like, I can't predict the future, but I'm very interested. So I guess that's my half-assed answer.
So you see, like, CNN and MSNBC, like, continue with this rapid pace, and, you know, on the right, too, but continue with this, like, rapid pace of, like, breaking news, Trump stapled his balls to the desk or something like that. But just, yeah. Like, this constant, like, I mean, like, this last 3 weeks has been, because every day I go through like YouTube and I check like the clips, and it's almost, it's addicting, but at the same time it's like sad, because it's like, yeah, Detroit's, you know, school system like doesn't have any water for kids to drink, and like thousands of kids are impacted, or like there's, you know, new laws that Trump is trying to push, you know, that will push forward like indefinite detention for migrants, and just like all this horrible shit that no one is talking about and would actually implicate the regime and like horrible things. But I don't know. But that's interesting. You're saying you think that that's going to like continue at that pace.
I don't think there's any going back. Like, you can't put that genie back in a bottle, especially now that I think like the consumption, our consumption has changed, right? Like, even looking at Twitter, like literally every account I follow, even like cute cats or like just random metal band XYZ, like even they're tweeting about this shit. Right. Like, in terms of media, like online coverage, like once I feel like once all these digital media entities have gotten a taste of those Trump clicks, they're gonna change their traffic goals, they're gonna change their behavior to continue getting those clicks. And even if Trump isn't, you know, stepping on his own dick every other day, like Bernie will do something, or whoever is in power will do something, or there'll be some, or there's always going to be something. And I think the public's appetite for this sort of constant horrifying feedback loop, it has just insatiable at this point. Like, I don't think we're just broken now. Like, so that's cool.
Well, let's switch gears and talk about metal now. You know, I'm going to be honest. I feel like one of my first like introductions was reading The Bloody Rise of the Satanic Metal Underground. What was that book? Is that what it's called? It's about black metal in Norway.
Yeah, it's called Lords of Chaos.
The Lords of Chaos.
Yeah, one of the co-writers
is
fucking fascist.
Right, right. I was like, oh my lord. I don't know if I agree with this. But I'm just curious, like, because, like, to me, growing up, I was always interested in, like, punk and, like, hip-hop, which was more, not to say that metal is not, like, based in reality, but definitely has strong elements of, like, fantasy and, you know, stuff like that. But I'm just curious, you know, what kind of drew you to it and, like, continues to draw you to it, like, as an anarchist?
So, I mean, I've been into heavy metal since I was about 11. And at that point, growing up where I did, where Walmart was the only music retailer, and it was like the late 90s, early 2000s, like, that meant Limp Bizkit and Korn and Slipknot and all of that ridiculous shit. And I'm from such a rural, isolated place that it's not like I could just walk into Sam Goody and pick and choose, you know? It's like, okay, my friends were listening to Papa Roach and Limp Bizkit, and some of my other friends were listening to Britney Spears and like Good Charlotte. So I had like limited options. And I was really drawn to just the aggression and like the heaviness and just like the fucking riffs and guitar noises. And just, it just felt really dark and heavy and ugly. And I really liked that as like an angry 11-year-old weird like little girl. Right. And I guess I've always held on to that. Like, metal is so metal is the best and metal is the fucking worst. Like, I love it more than anything and I fucking hate it. It's just been such a huge concept. It's been one of the biggest parts of my identity since I was little. And it's always going to be. It's given up some real estate in terms of my identity, because I'm much more, I'd probably tell you I was an anarchist before I tell you I was a metalhead now, even though I'm covered in like metal tattoos and I've got metal records. And I love metal. It's my favorite thing. And it's given me so much and I've given it so much. And I, you know, it sounds sort of sappy, but I do feel like it saved my life. Like when I needed it, when bad things are happening in my life, metal's always been there. And I know a lot of other people feel the same way. And I've always wanted people, all kinds of people except fascists, to feel welcome here, because metal has meant so much to me and done so much for me. And I still think it's the best genre. And I want everyone to feel like they have access to and are welcome in those spaces. And that's just not how it is now. And I've kind of dedicated a big chunk of my career in metal to trying to force that conversation and trying to force those doors open, because metal rules and everybody should be able to feel like they can go up and bang their head, like, no matter,
right,
you know, their identity or where they're from or, you know, whatever. Like, metal's for everyone. Well, right. You know, you're dope. So, I don't know, I'm a metalhead. I can't escape it. That's just who I am.
Someone once told me that was very involved in metal that the average metalhead tends to skew to the right, just like, you know, the average, like, punk rocker might skew towards, you know, some, like, vague leftism. And I'm just curious, you know, where you brought everybody except fascists, like, do you feel that there's still, like, a sizable National Socialist black metal contingent, or even just, like, a right-wing or far-right presence within metal, and just what does that look like?
Ugh, it sucks. So, I wouldn't say that it's sizable. In terms of, so there's, like, layers to this shit, right? And metal, it must be said, is such a massively global phenomenon, too, like, you know, there's metal everywhere, like South America and like Southeast Asia has a killer scene, like Siberia is killing it. Like it's hard to generalize, but in terms of, let's say, just like the American metal scene, right? There aren't that many straight up Nazis, but there are a lot of people who are either not especially concerned with whether or not they're listening to music by Nazis or wearing Nazi t-shirts, or people who do skew to the right, who are fine with the idea of it, who think Phil Anselmo is great, who think people that are anti-racist or anti-sexist are just, you know, crybabies and trying to make metal safe. Like, there's a very, I wouldn't say that metal specifically skews right wing. I would say there is a very pronounced reactionary element. And there is this, there's also, metal has this rebellious streak, of course, and it has this sort of, like, chip on its shoulder hangover from the PMRC in the 80s, when there was this, like, this government push to censor a ton of metal records for being lewd or violent or whatever. So anything that smells of censorship at all to a lot of metal people is completely unacceptable. If I go up to somebody in like a Satanic Warmaster shirt and like, hey, why are you wearing a fucking Nazi shirt? They go, what do you mean? Like, what, whatever, like, metal's supposed to be dangerous. Like, what do you care? You're trying to make, like, it's just very, very defensive. Like, a ton of metalheads tend to skew more apolitical than anything. So, and metal is such a deeply personal thing for so many people. Like, it's a huge part of our identity that when someone comes up and is like, hey, that thing that you're doing or representing or supporting is bad, and you doing that is a bad thing, they take that very personally as you saying, well, you're bad. And of course, their reaction to that is not going to be positive. But I mean, I don't.
So what do you say to a kid if you see him wearing a Burzum shirt or something like that? What do you say to them? What's your elevator pitch?
It's like, hey, well, I happened at a bar a few weeks ago. I saw a guy in a Graveland shirt. I went to him. He was sitting by himself. And he's like, hey, what's up with your shirt, dude? It's like, oh, what do you mean? Well, you know, they're a Nazi band. It's like, well, no, like, well, they said on Facebook that they weren't, like, whatever. I'm like, yeah, but, like, they're kind of the reason that, you know, Polish black metal in the 90s developed this National Socialist bend. You know that history, right? It's like, well, yeah, but they're, like, cool now. Like, I don't know. Like, yeah, I feel like that. You shouldn't really be wearing that shirt, my dude. Ooh, like, I'm not, yeah, I'll talk to you and try to make you understand that you're doing something shitty. And if it becomes apparent, you know, that you don't care or that you're actively promoting that, it's just like, okay, well, that's the side you're on, you're a piece of shit, bye. Like, it's, you know, there's metal is so complicated. I feel like I would need like an entire other hour to get into all of this, right, and I'm right. not coming off as reductive, because there are, to speak to like the other side of that, there are so many, especially in recent years, I've seen this huge upswing in sort of metal resistance, like people resisting these reactionary impulses and speaking out against these reactionary idiots who are trying to ruin metal and keep it for themselves. Like, there's so many left-wing labels and left-wing bands, like tons, like there's this whole new sort of baby wave of explicitly anti-fascist black metal that's been making huge waves. I wrote about that recently. In addition to, there have always been left-wing bands in heavy metal, like mm-hmm. always. And there have always been politics in metal, always. That's something that so many metalheads will just refuse to acknowledge. Like, I'm sorry, my guy, have you ever heard War Pigs? Do you think that was a pro-war thing?
Yeah, exactly.
Metal, like, call Tony Iommi, see how he feels about that. Like a working-class kid who got his fingers lopped off on a Birmingham factory. Tell him there's no politics in metal. But it's been extremely heartening and, like, really, like, it's just been really nice to see that so many, like, writers and artists and label people and just, like, fans and metal people in general are speaking out against this stuff and pushing back and creating their own explicitly political, explicitly left-wing, explicitly anti-fascist work, because we need that, because there is nothing metal about conforming to, you know, the bullshit ideals your racist uncle spews at the dinner table. Like, if you're out here doing some Rush Limbaugh black metal, like, you are not dangerous, you are just sad.
Rush Limbaugh black metal.
Yeah.
Oh. So, is it true that you are putting on some sort of anti-fascist black metal event soon? And also, for those of us that are new to metal or would just like some names to look up on YouTube, what are some bands that you would recommend that have good politics?
Okay, so I'll do the bands first, because that's my favorite part. So, okay. There's so many. I write about them a lot. There's a whole blog. It's been around for a long time. RABM Blogspot, Red Anarchist Black Metal Blogspot. You can Google it. Mm-hmm. They just have a constant stream of political left-wing, like, anarchist-approved metal bands from across the genres. I would say some things that I've been loving recently are Dawn Raid. Panopticon is a great one. Iskra are the gods. Not a Cost is amazing. Appalachian Terror Unit. Vile Creature.
That's more crust punk, though.
Yeah, there's a little bit of crossover. That one's not quite. I'm just kind of looking at my t-shirt collection right now. I'm like, oh. Yeah, that was a bad one. But they're great. But,
yeah, they are great.
Twilight Fauna is a great one. There's labels like Tridoid Records. And, God, there's so many. I wish I could just send you a playlist or something to put on the site.
Sure.
Would you like that?
I don't know how the fans would react, but. No, yeah. But are you planning on doing some sort of like music festival at some point, or?
Yeah, this is a thing. It's really funny. It speaks to the power of the internet. Uh-huh. That I was just sitting around talking to somebody one day, like, man, I wish that I could just book my own anti-fascist black metal fest and not have to be jealous of everything that's happening in Europe or in England. I was like, what if I'll just tweet that thought out, like, y'all just give me some money to do this. And then a bunch of people were really interested, and I was like, maybe I should try to do this. And I've talked to a couple of people and, like, tried to figure out some funding structures, because, like, of course you want to be able to pay everybody. And there's a lot that goes into booking a big event and doing it right and doing it, like, ethically. So I'm still figuring it all out, but I'm pretty sure I'm going to be able to pull it off. And I'm looking at the early months of 2019 in New York City. I've talked to a few bands already who are down. I think it's going to be pretty cool. I just have to put all the moving pieces together and see what I can pull off. But I figure if anybody can pull this shit off, it's going to be me, because I'm like,
awesome.
Heavy metal Antifa big sister at this point. So
we would love to sponsor it or help out in any capacity. That sounds awesome. So last question before we sign off is, what do people need to know about the unionization efforts happening in Vice and other big publications? I mean, we see them popping up all over, but what's going on? What have been some of the big wins? And just tell us about it.
Oh, man, I could do, like, a whole hour just on that.
Sure.
That's my other thing. I'm like a union mom advice. right now, Well, right now, at Vice specifically, so we have two bargaining units. There's one, Vice Production TV and Digital, which are currently in the midst of negotiating their first contract. They organized in 2016, I believe, or 17. And Vice Editorial, we organized in 2015. So we are now gearing up, actually later this month, to start bargaining our second contract. And I'm so proud. I'm like a proud mom. Because our first contract was so good, and it really addressed a lot of the material concerns that people had, because people were being like desperately underpaid, overworked, all the things that happen when you work in like a fucking capitalist society, right? But like under this veneer of like hip new media, we're cool though. That was, you know, whatever. I have a lot of thoughts about that too. But yeah, media unionization, it's great. There have been so many shops that have organized under the Writers Guild of America East, which is my union. There's Thrillist, HuffPo, Gizmodo Media Group, Vice is in there, of course, Think Progress, DNA Info, and Gothamist were under that banner before their shitty billionaire owner killed them off. The Onion is another really exciting one. Vox is a great one. I feel terrible. I'm going to forget some of my children by not naming everybody.
Mike?
But now, Mike is with the News Guild, which is interesting. They're organizing some digital media properties, too. I think they're more of a traditional newspaper union, though, so like they're dipping their toes in. That's cool. More, all power to her. More unionization is good. Mm-hmm. But it's just been, you know, it's been really heartening and really satisfying to see this unionization wave really hit and keep rolling, because it does demonstrably improve workers' lives. Like digital media workers, like it seems like a cool, fun job, and in some ways it is, but it's also fucking terrible sometimes. Like there are very few jobs where you have to spend half your day dealing with death threats from Nazis on every possible platform just because you wrote about something. And yeah, workers are they're overworked and underpaid and undervalued. The workplace safety is not what it should be. Like the workplace culture is not what it should be. It's, you know, there's a lot that needs to be improved, and organizing and working collectively together and bargaining together is, I think, the most effective way to affect that kind of change in a, you know, besides outside of blowing it all up, which is always an option. But, you know, right now the whole organizing thing is working pretty well. Yeah. And, you know, I'm always down to talk to people about organizing the workplace if they do work in the digital realm. Like, I get very excited about it. I know you have to go, so I'm trying to talk extra fast. But I hope that kind of answers your question.
Oh, yeah.
We're killing it.
Oh, well, I was just going to say in closing, how can people follow your work? Where should they be pointed to stay in touch and keep up with what you're doing?
Well, I'm super online. It's terrible. But I'm just very much – I'm on Twitter. I'm very much on Twitter at Grim Kim, because still metal. That was my college radio name, and now I can never escape it. That was my college DJ name, and I was like, oh, that works for Twitter. I don't know what Twitter is now 10 years later. All right, still Grim Kim. But yeah, like, I don't really do that much other social media, but there's that. I mean, I have an author page on Teen Vogue. I have an author page on Vice. Twitter's the easiest thing. I'm way too online. But yeah, I always tweet out articles and retweet and try to support other people's work too. So I guess just follow me, like, or hit me up. You can email me. I'm pretty easy to find.
Awesome.
As long as you're not going to be a dick. Deal with a lot of those.
Right. Well, hey, thanks so much for taking the time to talk to us, and encourage everybody to check out your work. And look forward to seeing what comes next.
Thank you so much, comrade. Take care.
This has been the It's Going Down podcast. Check itsgoingdown.org for daily updates, columns, action reports, and news. Go to itsgoingdown.org/shop to support us. And follow us on all social media platforms. IGD, your daily resource for insurgent proletarian life.